And I'm not suggesting that he should go to prison now. I'm suggesting that he should go to court and be forced to answer those questions, and that after he answers those questions, hey, you know, if he's got an airtight alibi with, you know, all of this, you know, credible substantiation of his story, I'm wrong, I guess.
All he needs is one good hooker story. Partying for 3 days.
Well, I don't doubt that after 3 days, right, after they killed him, oh, yeah, you got dead hookers all over the place, I'm sure. Right? I'm sure there was a wake of dead hookers in Florida on July 17th, 18th, and 19th. But I don't really want to go there.
Okay. Fair enough. Bizarre
people. There's one other point. If we have time to talk about, speaking of flight instructors, it's one of the things that I deal with in the video, and it is, you know, if somebody has a bright idea about continuing an investigation, there is this, I deal with it in the video, that the headline the day after the NTSB report came out, it came out a year, almost to the day after the plane crash, the headline is that Kennedy told a flight instructor that he wanted to do it alone. And the video has, I mean, it's one of the major pieces of investigative work that I did, is regarding this, because you then go and you look at the story, right? The report says that the instructor says that Kennedy wanted to do it alone, but then when you go and you get the statements of this particular flight instructor, he wrote a letter 5 days after the plane crash to the NTSB saying that he spoke to John in the morning and that he called John because he wanted to tell him that he had his keys and see whether John wanted to return them. Well, I spoke to witnesses who were very, very, very familiar with John, with his flight instructor, and with the situation with the keys and so on, and they said that's an obvious lie. You would never call, you didn't call John anyhow. John would call you. But if you were calling John, you wouldn't be calling him about such a matter, in addition to which, John told Blow and everybody else in the world that he was going to have a flight instructor. He had to have had a conversation with some flight instructor to arrange that he was going to have a flight instructor. I don't think there's any question that that conversation between John and a flight instructor that morning was arranging for John to have a flight instructor. I don't think it can be any shadow of a doubt that the conversation that this guy admits that he has and that the phone records show was regarding the fact that this guy was supposed to accompany John on the flight that evening. Well, obviously, this guy didn't accompany John because he's still alive, but so he lies in this letter to the NTSB about the nature of that conversation. Then there's a long page and a half summary of the conversation that he had the same day with the NTSB investigator. Nothing in there about John telling him that he wanted to do it alone. Nothing in the letter about him telling John that he wanted to do it alone. 6 months later, according to the NTSB, this guy's signature is not on it. It is not a well-done document. It's a couple of lines. That this guy now says that he talked to John in the morning and John said that he wanted to do it alone. Now this guy works for a company and he's represented by a lawyer. Well, you can't just talk to the guy without having his lawyer present or getting permission and so on, and they didn't do any of that stuff. So they call up the lawyer, and they sent the lawyer, I don't know what they sent the lawyer, and I don't know what they did, but the lawyer wrote a letter back saying this guy did not talk to John about flying on the morning of the plane crash. It didn't happen. So the guy's lawyer says the guy's lying when he says that John told him that he wanted to do it alone. But nevertheless, despite the fact that the statement is absolutely not credible, given what is in the NTSB files, the NTSB put it in their report, and the news picked it up, and the news put it in the headline, and it is the absolutely least credible suggestion of anything that is suggested by the NTSB report. That one is the least credible, and they all made that the headline. I called this guy up, and I said, hey, you know, what's going on? How come your lawyer says you're lying? And he says, oh, listen, whatever I told the NTSB, that's the truth. And then he hung up the phone on me. Well, it seems to me that if there was a law enforcement official who was interested in pursuing this, they could arrest the guy for lying to the NTSB and, you know, sentence him to 100 years in prison and then see if he was willing to talk. But I got to tell you, I don't really think that's going to happen.
No, probably not.
But, well, 20 years from now, or 2 years from now, right, with a different administration, if the right people were to get elected to office, there's no telling what could happen. Anyhow, are we ready to wrap it up? You want to
I think we're getting close there, but perhaps you could let us know what's next on the agenda for you, and if there's anything that we didn't touch on here that you'd like to bring up.
I would like to point out that my favorite book on the Kennedy assassination, I think, is Plausible Denial by Mark Lane, and it has. Mark Lane talked to Colonel Prouty about the ships. It has all of that stuff in it. Mark Lane's first book was Rush to Judgment, and that book was written completely on based on the Warren Commission documents. And so, in fact, that's the approach that I tried to take, right, that this thing has been based almost entirely on the Warren Commission documents. On the NTSB documents. And I think that that's a very, very reputable way to proceed. Let me talk about a bomb for a minute. I said that there's nothing in the NTSB report to support the suggestion of a bomb, and I think that when you're dealing with a report that's 500 pages long, we saw with the Warren Commission, you know, you can take the report and throw it in the garbage, but the documents that are associated with it, geez, are just loaded with stuff. And I think that if there were a bomb involved in the explosion of John's plane, that would be reflected some kind of way. And it just isn't. It's not reflected in the scattering of the wreckage, which in fact was not scattered, but was rather concentrated. There is one reputable witness, that is to say that the guy is named, and he was a doctor and he was off fishing. He didn't see any sort of a flash, but he did say that he heard a boom. He says he wasn't looking out over the water, but he did hear a boom, and that's it. You're at the end of the line. There is a guy who said that he saw a flash, it was alleged in the news that there was an individual who said that he saw a flash, but nobody knows what his name was. And in addition to which, I think that you could explain a flash because, I mean, clearly, these guys didn't plan to take 15 and a half hours to recover the body. The plane sank. It wasn't supposed to sink. They were, no doubt, waiting in the water where the plane was supposed to go down, and, you know, it's a big ocean, and they lost it, and the plane actually did sink. But if they lost it, they were looking for it, and if they were looking for it, it seems to me entirely plausible that they would have fired up an illuminating flare in order to try to find it. And I would suggest that if somebody saw something...
What you're alluding to there is you are alluding to information of some ships already out in the area right away.
Oh, I'm certain that there, you know, if my story is correct, of course there were boats out there who were supposed to recover the body of the flight instructor immediately. I mean, the plan was not to provoke the Kennedys and have this outrageous 15-hour delay. The plan was, of course, the plane would crash and they would rush to it and yank this guy's body out and be on their way, but that didn't happen.
No,
and
as typical incompetence does take over in these things.
Typical incompetence.
So there was a massive delay, probably not intentional, as you point out. And I tend to have to agree, why would they want to provoke any possibility that there could be a backlash? It does seem illogical. And a delay in order to recover something, and actually something you didn't bring up was the logbook, which is normally on the plane, and the duffel bag, which it was supposed to be in, was accounted for. And,
right.
And that would have told who was in the plane.
Right. The CNN says that the Aquamarine duffel was recovered. The one of the witnesses that I interviewed, who was very, very determined that he should remain nameless, says that he was watching CNN, that he's very familiar with John, knew that John kept his flight log in this Aquamarine duffel, and that he saw he was watching the television on CNN. He saw the duffel being recovered, and then it gets mentioned in the CNN report as having been recovered and as having been intact. Which is more evidence that if there was a bomb, it certainly wasn't in the luggage compartment, which is in the tail, right? So that the allegation is that looking at the way the plane went straight down, if you want to make a plane straight go straight down, you put the bomb in the tail. But the luggage was in the tail, and the luggage was all intact, right? I mean, Lauren Bessette's briefcase washed up with her. I mean, it looks like it was pulled off a supermarket shelf. It's in very, very good condition, and her name was legible.
Right. Well, this is a small point. I mean, you're talking about the actual records of where the plane was last in the air and where it hit. So if someone put a bomb in there, there's murder. If someone sabotaged the plane, it's murder. If it was a Manchurian candidate, it's murder.
Oh, sure. So, no, it's just that I've taken some criticism by people who were committed to the bomb story. And like I was saying, with the Warren Commission, you can rely on the Warren Commission documents in order to establish a lot of important information about what happened, because a lot of the truth ends up in the documents, and there is nothing in the documents of the John Kennedy Jr. assassination to suggest in any way, nothing, not a shred, to suggest that there was a bomb on the plane. You asked me about what I'm going to do next, and I actually would like to talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
One of the things I wanted to do is, we're opening up kind of a can of worms here, but I wanted to do a quick video on 9/11. There's been some really, really, really excellent stuff. If people in your audience haven't seen Professor Jones from BYU's presentation, I think you can see it at question911.com. I think you can actually go there and watch the whole thing, but I would also encourage you to buy it. Global Outlook is selling it, and I would encourage you to get it from them because, they're really great. Right, they've been at the forefront of the 9/11 movement since very, very early on. But anyhow, this guy's a physicist, and in terms of the buildings being brought down, it's just amazing. And it's very similar to the Kennedy Sr. assassination in that way, right? You got how many? 20,000 people who are serious investigators out there pushing this stuff, and the evidence just continues to roll in. That hasn't been the case with John Kennedy Jr. As far as I know, I'm the only guy who's done a serious investigation, touched it in the last 6 years. But with John Kennedy Sr., you had a bunch of people, and with 9/11, you have a bunch of people. And with John Kennedy Sr., you can really nail George Bush Sr. for being involved in the assassination. And with 9/11, it is so clear, right? I mean, there are very, very, very reputable people coming forward. There was some guy on Alex Jones the other day. Somebody sent me the email of it, who is very high in the Strategic Air Command, or NORAD, and maybe it was under Reagan. It was one of the previous administrations. I mean, this guy was like number one or number two, very, very high ranking, saying this was an inside job. This is just outrageous. It's, the highest treason imaginable. But I think that, let me say that, I teach high school, and in teaching high school, if you are boring, you are done. And so one of the things, and occasionally there will be somebody who thinks that I'm not being sufficiently respectful of the topic because, if there's something I can do, if there's something funny that I can stick in, I will stick in something funny. In any case, I don't try to pretend to be objective. I don't try to pretend to not have a point of view. I do rely on absolutely the best evidence that I can get, but I think that people will find these videos are entertaining. You can take them and you can show them to your nephews and your nieces and your children and your grandchildren, and they will watch them because, they are designed to be very, very, very palatable. I would like to do a presentation on 9/11 that is that as well, right? That is very, very palatable while presenting all of the absolute best evidence that there is. When I finish doing that, one of the things, if nobody invites me to do anything else, I want to do something on the Holocaust, and I'd like to talk about that for just a minute. One of these Holocaust deniers, and I'm happy to call this guy every expletive in the book. I think he is just an enormous criminal jerk. I'm not particularly happy that anybody gets put in prison for something that they said, but he got sentenced to prison for denying the Holocaust. Well, I don't approve of that. I think that people should be free to speak out, and here's a perfect example of why. Because I never learn anything talking to somebody who agrees with me 100%, right? You just hear your own thoughts reflected back at you, and you learn by talking to people who disagree with you. And this guy says, he makes, I think, a fabulously interesting point. He says, look at the amount of coal that it would take to incinerate the bodies at Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and the rest. Calculate that. Calculate the dent that that's going to make in the German economy. Calculate the number of workers and soldiers and trains and track that are going to have to be diverted from the war effort in order to accomplish this, and then put it in the context of the war effort. This is it. The Battle of Stalingrad is absolutely raging, right? The people don't know, probably, about the Battle of Stalingrad. The United States was not involved in World War II. The United States had a couple hundred thousand casualties. The Russians had 20 million. I think that's 0.1%. The U.S. involvement, and I don't mean to denigrate the contributions of the brave and proud Americans who fought. My father was one of them, and or denigrate their contribution. But at the height of D-Day, at the height of D-Day, Hitler was so panicked that he moved 25, I think, divisions from the Russian front to the Allied front, leaving a mere 200 divisions on the Russian front, so that the Allies were facing something like 30 divisions, while the Russians were facing, for the bulk of the war, were facing 230 divisions and then 200 divisions. You do the math and calculate the percentages. They were locked, and in this death struggle at Stalingrad, the U.S., the Allies didn't invade until that battle was over, right? D-Day occurred after the Battle of Stalingrad had been won very decisively, and the Russian army was now advancing about as fast as they could walk towards Berlin, but, you know, they had 1,500 miles to go. In the middle of this death struggle, the Holocaust denier says this, you want to suggest that Hitler would divert all of these resources. If he won the Battle of Stalingrad, he could exterminate every single Jew in Europe, every single Jew in Russia at his leisure if he had won that battle, and instead he diverts these resources from the battle, loses the battle. This doesn't make any sense. And I have to agree. I mean, how can you argue? It positively does not make any sense. How can you possibly explain it? Well, and you tell me when you want me to quit on this subject, because like I said, this is my next project and I can go on for a long time, but let me just quickly say that if you ask the question, qui bono, who benefits, you can now say very, very, very quickly that Hitler did not benefit from the Holocaust. The German army certainly did not benefit from the Holocaust. There is, by the way, a lot of really, really important research. Hitler was a stooge. Hitler was a puppet. Hitler was a creation of German army intelligence. That's his mainstream history. There is also a considerable amount of evidence that Hitler was, well, it doesn't matter, that Hitler was one quarter Jewish, and in fact that he was a descendant of the Rothschilds. The chairman of my history department told me that was mainstream history. I haven't researched it myself to be able to say that that's the case. In any case, the point is this one. Who benefited from the Holocaust?
Right. Now,
You didn't answer the question. I'm waiting for you to answer the question.
Well, who benefited from the Holocaust?
The Rothschilds.
Yeah, okay, fair
enough.
And
the Rockefellers, and the L.A. Times gave the figure of $1 trillion they benefited from the Holocaust. $1 trillion in deposits by Jewish people in Poland and Germany and France that they did not have to pay back because those people had been exterminated. Now, I make the point in the video that this was a 2-inch paragraph in the LA Times that it had come out in the records that during World War, Chase Manhattan Bank in Paris seized the assets of their Jewish depositors and then ordered Hitler to tell them to do it. They seized the assets of their Jewish depositors on their own initiative and had to get Hitler to back them up, which only falls right into a neat slot behind the fact that what I just said, that all of the evidence shows, demonstrates that Hitler was a creation and a tool of German army intelligence. Let me let you interrupt me.
Personally, I've maintained for a long time that Hitler was pretty much a front man for these guys, so I think we're on a reasonable track there. And I'll tell you, I think that there's a real big problem that nobody's allowed to talk about the Holocaust. And I don't think it's a matter of denying the Holocaust to say that there might be some inconsistencies with numbers and differences of opinion.
I don't believe that. I don't think there's any inconsistency.
Or just even who it was that pulled the trigger or made the orders or arranged the deaths. Well, but the problem is we're not allowed to talk. This Ernst Zendel is a great example. What happens if you talk about the Holocaust in a country where it's illegal and we're supposed to have free press. This is a very important issue, and I hope that you're getting labeled a Holocaust denier doesn't stop the rest of your stuff from getting out. But
Holocaust, I'm sorry, if I'm talking about you, I don't mean it personally, but I think Holocaust deniers are disgusting scum. I don't mind saying it.
No, and that's not me. And I think most people that actually are painted as Holocaust deniers, and I think this is my point, aren't actually denying the Holocaust entirely always, maybe just presenting different viewpoints, and that's something that
the whole thing has got an uncomfortable tone around the topic. So first of all, just to talk about it, you're kind of treading lightly in that area. But if you're doing research on it and you're talking about you're going to back up where these things led and was Hitler a puppet and who was really pulling the strings and who was behind this war, that's a different story I'm interested in.
Well, I think is the reason, listen, I told you about the LA Times story, right?
Yep.
That story appeared on the face of the earth nowhere except the LA Times. I'm going to say that again. Right, Dow Jones News Retrieval Service reads, I think, 5,000 newspapers and magazines around the globe. In Israel, they did not print that story. In nowhere on the face of the earth did that story appear except in the LA Times. So that, you see, I think there's more to it. I don't think it's accidental. I'm sure that there are people within the Jewish community who are agents of the Rockefellers whose job is to make sure that anybody who tries to do anything like an intelligent analysis of what transpired ends up being tarred. I mean, I tried to, right? I live in L.A. The Holocaust Museum, the Simon Wiesenthal Center is in L.A. I spent a couple of weeks there going through all of this stuff. And I'm sitting in the Holocaust Museum, and so let me say that the evidence that I saw there suggested that, I mean, these are not my words, that Hitler was not anti-Semitic. In fact, Hitler never said an anti-Semitic. In all of the research that has been done, and you can believe that there has been an enormous amount of research done, Hitler never made an anti-Semitic remark until he was in the employ of German Army Intelligence and they assigned him to do it. Now, let me tell you something that you perhaps almost undoubtedly don't know. Am I invited to run on for another 5 minutes?
Sure. We're going to have to wrap up pretty quick, but we can finish off the points.
So, at the end of World War Two, no, sorry, World War One. At the end of World War One, Hitler was in Munich, and there was a communist revolution in Munich. The communists seized the local government, and the army sat in their barracks and did nothing. Well, how do you account for that? Well, I think that you can account for it the same way that you can account for that the most avid supporters of the Bolshevik Revolution were the army, because these are the guys who are dying in this freaking insane war that has been started by the Kaiser and the Tsar, and they are not the most avid supporters of the Kaiser and the Tsar, and when these guys seized the government, the army was very, very supportive. Well, one of the, and I'm going to call this guy Nazi because I don't think that's the wrong word, but he is a Nazi supporter of the Kaiser, and he's a general, and he puts together his army, and he comes marching into Munich and goes down to City Hall and kills everybody, summarily executes everybody that they find at City Hall, and then he goes down to the barracks and arrests all of the soldiers and starts torturing them to find out who the ringleaders are. And Hitler is one of the people who gets tortured, and the descriptions of him suggest that he looked like he had been tortured, and under torture, he started naming names of all of his friends, who then all got executed. On the basis of his cooperation, Hitler gets recruited into German Army Intelligence. They take him and they give him speech lessons. They then bring in a room full of prisoners of war who the French were holding and who were about to be released, and they sit these prisoners down, and Hitler stands up and gives them this fiery anti-Semitic speech. The soldiers get up and leave. The teachers sit down and critique Hitler's speech and delivery. They bring in the next group. Hitler stands up and gives the speech again. They leave. They critique the delivery and the speech again. They bring in the next group now. They send him in to organize. They send him as a spy into the German Workers' Party, which is what is going to become the Nazi Party. Hitler joins the group. They are going to have a meeting. They're going to invite people to a public meeting. Hitler goes back. The German Wehrmacht then puts up posters all over town inviting people to come to this meeting. These guys are used to having 20 people at a really, really crowded meeting. They would get 20. A lot of the time, 5 or 6, and all they're doing is sitting around drinking anyway. And 300 people show up. These guys are absolutely floored, and most of them are stage-struck, right? They're all nervous. Hitler stands up and gives this fabulous speech and, you know, thunderous applause. And right, I mean, he's been well-trained, and he gives a decent speech. And, you know, of course, he's head and shoulders beyond the rest of these guys. And when the thing is over, he says, "You guys are going to make me the Führer, or I quit, and I'm going to take my marbles and my football and go. And if you guys want to go back to having meetings of 8 people where you sit around getting drunk, go ahead. But, you know, if you want to have meetings like this, you need to make me the Führer." And so they make him the Führer. And one of his the first time that he ever says anti-Semitic is at the direction of German Army intelligence, and that is absolutely documented. Right, that is
well,
what the most...
Well, that's very interesting, but I also feel, though, it's kind of a different topic, and we should
no,
have
sure,
you
absolutely.
On for...
absolutely. But
yeah.
It's what I'm doing next.
Yeah.
That's the answer to the question is what I'm doing next. Let me... If we're going to wrap it up, I got a closing speech.
Okay.
Okay, which is this one. Right, I mean, all this stuff is really, 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 really depressing. And the one thing... The two things I want to say is that, first of all... I was watching the History Channel one day, and they had this thing about the Vatican and how the Pope was having orgies at the Vatican. Alexander VI was having orgies at the Vatican. And, all of the people in the city of Rome were complaining about these parades of naked girls going into the Vatican. So there's all kinds of witnesses to this effect. They then say, at the orgy at the Vatican, the Pope had sex with his daughter. And I said, wait a minute, you know, I'm as anti-Pope as anybody you're likely to find. But I am not buying that one. And then they say, we know this because he signed a papal bull. Not only were there people who were outraged, people who signed on to go to an orgy, but an orgy where the Pope was going to have sex with his daughter, he signed a papal bull acknowledging her son as his child. Well, I'm sorry if the Pope said it. And so the point is that the Pope thought he could do with this stuff and get away with it. Right? He thought that the Catholic Church's power in Europe was so outrageous, so complete, that he could do this stuff. People don't read. They don't, you know, they're totally ignorant. All they know is what the priests tell them, and the priests are never going to tell them this story. They're never going to find out. But this was the middle of the Renaissance, and you have all of these merchants traveling all over Europe, and they took the story around. And when Martin Luther was ready to stand up to the Pope, the German people were ready to back him because they knew the truth of the matter. And when Henry VIII was ready to stand up to the Pope, the English people were ready to back him because they knew the truth of the matter. And people should not underestimate the importance of talking to your neighbors and talking to your friends and talking to your family and have the ugly, uncomfortable conversation about September 11th. Do that. It's been important for 1,000 years, and it's still important. Martin Luther King said, The evil people involved in what's going on in the South are a handful, and it is the good people who do nothing that makes these guys, the evil people, powerful. Cesar Chavez said exactly the same thing. Alex Jones says, we're on the front lines. It's your life to win or lose, and if you're in the trenches, you're on the front lines, you got to give it back to them 110%. And so that's my close, is that don't underestimate your... I'm speaking to your audience and to you as well. We need to not underestimate our ability to affect history by talking to the guy next door and to the guy at the bus stop and to the guy at the store and to the people that you have everyday contact with and bringing this stuff up, taking that to heart. I mean, I just moved into a building. There's all these people. I can't find somebody who doesn't think that the Bushes did September 11th.
Yeah, that's quite the thing. And I was just mentioning to Nita, I didn't know that about the Pope. What you're talking about, these orgies and things like that, but some of these are just so uncomfortable to bring up. I think the first of all, when you talk to a lay person, you know, even a year or two after 9/11, just to bring up that thought, it's unpatriotic, it's un-American. How dare you? Now, years later, people are not really saying how dare you. They're saying, well, show me. And a lot of people like Jim Fetzer and David Ray Griffin and that, they're out in the front line there saying, if you want us to show you, here it is.
Right. Absolutely. Well, they need help.
Right. First of all, and like you say, with your DVD, there is some parts that I know what you're talking about, where you have some animations that they're kind of like cheeky, sarcastic, and that helps to keep the thing entertaining. So it's not you. How can you watch a really dry documentary unless you're hooked already? So if you're showing it to somebody new, they want to see something, and every now and then you've got this. Well, what do you mean this could happen? Or what do you know? So I understand that. It's a good point about you making it entertaining.
Actually, and also on that, if I might add to it too, I think when you're talking about introducing this kind of thing to people who have their defenses up, that type of approach is actually quite disarming, and it allows the actual information to get through a lot better. So when you're talking about dealing with kids, it's really a good approach. For people who are hardened researchers, they might not really understand it quite so quickly, but I think you're a high school teacher. You appreciate the need to be able to get your points across while keeping people entertained.
And let me say this last thing, that, I forget where I ran into it, but somebody was saying that they had been to, I was reading somebody who had been at the Professor Jones presentation and said that it's very, very, very difficult to get people to even conceive of the possibility that the government could have done such a thing. And see, when September 11th happened, I stopped working on this Kennedy stuff because I thought, no. So people don't know, and somebody's got to do it. And then, you know, I see this when I was satisfied that there were other people waking up to it and that there was going to be a 9/11 movement, I was able to step back and say, all right, now listen, should I be doing what everybody else is doing? Or, and I really think that, it's clear, 80% of the American people already think that the government was involved in the Kennedy assassination. That's an in. That's a foothold. That's a place that you can start and move from. So that, and that's why one of the main reasons that I was able to say, yes, I should go ahead with what I'm doing and let somebody else do 9/11 is because I think that this demonstrates the morality of these people, and it demonstrates it starting with a foothold, a place that they're already at, that they know that they've been lied to about the Kennedy assassination. And then JFK, too, the real power of it is that it's very, 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 very solid, right? That the information there.
And not only that, if you want to talk about lying, do you recall George W. Bush saying with this Valerie Plame thing, I want to find the guy who leaked that, you know, and I'll have him fired. And he's the guy who leaked it, it turns out, today.
Right, right.
I mean, if this doesn't bring him down, nothing will.
Oh, nothing. So, this is not going to bring him down, you see, because if he's the president and he leaks it, well, he's authorized to leak it.
Yeah, but how about lying to the country for the last 2 or 3 years or whatever it was, at whatever length, right? He's just saying there, you know, they should be fired. They're not in my administration.
Oh, well, sure. Well, he lied, but I mean, everybody knows at this point, I think probably 90% of the people of the United States know that Bush lied about.
Well, I don't know. There's some, I mean, you'd think because of the split, because of the Republican-Democratic ideologies, that it would be 50-50. And,
oh, not at all. No. People understand that politicians lie. The fact that, oh, the politician lied, Kennedy lied, you know, whatever, right? Politicians lie. It's a fact. People aren't scandalized by the fact that a politician lied. You're not going to get them all excited about the fact that a politician lied. And most of all, you're not going to persuade them that just because this guy is capable of lying, which we all are capable of, that he's capable of killing 3,000 of his own citizens by attacking the World Trade Center in order to start a war and kill thousands and thousands and thousands of more innocent people, that they're not ready to accept that. And I do think that it is a valuable service provided by the JFK to the Bush connection, is that it establishes that these guys, it is a real insight into the morality of
yeah,
the
that
Bush
it
family.
Is. And it's very, your research, the way you've laid out your DVDs is very, I mean, you can, I urge everyone to get a copy of the DVD.
Well, I haven't found a Republican who has watched that and said, well, that's not true. And they say, oh, well, gee, I guess Bush Sr. did kill Kennedy. That is the only response I have ever gotten from anybody who has ever seen JFK 2. The most hardened Republican is, oh, gee, I guess he did. But that doesn't mean his son is the same way.
Yeah,
but I mean, that's a good place to start, right? When you can get them to it, if you can move them from where they're at, the step to saying, oh, well, the father was a murderer, okay, but that doesn't mean that the son was the same way. No, it doesn't mean that the son was the same way. You're right. Now let's watch Professor Jones's video and see whether that means that the son was the same way, and then I think you're done.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have you back as you get some more of your works out and let people know as they progress. So please keep us informed as things move along. And I'd like to know, you know, as this 9/11 one comes up also. But you're planning to do the Hitler focus, I gather, next. So if you have any kind of a schedule, please give us some notice, and we'll be happy to have you on and see that.
Well, very good.
All right. Well, I think we better get it wrapped up. So
sure.
Thank you for joining us. Very enlightening discussion, and people really must see this
right.
Video that you've done.
JFKII.com.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for joining
us. Or Amazon. Listen, thank you so much for the work that you do. It's, you know, great, invaluable, important work, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, very good to speak to you again, John.
Oh, hey. And, I mean, right, I want to quit my job so I can do this full-time. I have quit my job so that I can do this full-time. I need people to buy the video. You guys need people to contribute. Please, buy the video and contribute to Black Op Radio.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, we'll keep spreading the word for you.
Okay. Thanks a bunch.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us for one more episode of Black Op Radio, number 265. And I guess we're getting up there. What's the date? April 6th. Wow. Thank you. And we'll be joining you again next week.
Been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers recording studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network. Interviews with Colonel Al Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight. We are pleased to announce Volume 1 of Interviews with Colonel Al Fletcher Prouty on DVD. This first one-hour DVD goes through the 1960 U-2 incident with Gary Powers. Colonel Fletcher Prouty reveals his inside knowledge of the incident, his office in the Pentagon, Operation Aquatone, Soviet overflights, and the similar Alan Pope incident. It is Prouty's position that the U-2 flight was sabotaged by the members of a secret team to stop the crusade for peace and embarrass President Eisenhower, thereby heating up the Cold War. And of course, Eisenhower warned everyone of the industrialized military complex that he had learned of firsthand in this incident. You will learn Gary Powers' U-2 never was shot down at 70,000 feet, as claimed in every single history book. Four separate interviews on one DVD, a one-of-a-kind must-have for anyone interested in finding the truth behind the cover story. Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza.
available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
If you believe there's more to the JFK assassination and the mystery surrounding the CIA and its covert operations, you're not alone. Meet the man Oliver Stone called X in the epic motion picture JFK. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty comes forward with never-before-seen or heard documentation and information about JFK, the Vietnam War, the CIA, and more on a brand new CD-ROM. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty is an incredible offer not to be missed. For a limited time only, find the answers surrounding these issues and more with the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Call now at area code 604-525-4167. That's area code 604-525-4167. Or visit the Colonel Prouty reference site on the World Wide Web. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty.
The Colonel Prouty reference site, www.prouty.org. That's P-R-O-U-T-Y. Prouty.org. The Colonel Prouty reference site.
You've enjoyed Black Op Radio live and archived over the web, but now there's a way to listen without having to use valuable internet time. Order the Black Op Radio Archive CD-ROM. No more network congestion or buffering or file not found. The shows play right from your computer off the CD-ROM. Great for research or as a gift. For more details, check the website.